When the wind blows, the cradle will rock, right? Then what comes next? Down will come baby, cradle and all. Like, why would you sing that over a child? Like, can you imagine if the baby comprehended what you were singing? And the baby's like lying there like, why did you put me in the treetops? And like, how far is this fall? Like, how much at risk am I? Right? I mean, it's kind of crazy that we would sing those songs over our children. And I've heard it described or called the lullaby effect. In other words, we become so familiar with something that we actually disconnect ourselves from the meaning of what we're actually saying. This is a direct quote. It says, the lullaby effect anesthetizes us through the stupefying effects of familiarity. And I think it's a principle that probably applies to many areas of our life. If you get the concept of a lullaby effect, is that when you become familiar with anything on any level, you have the risk of it stopping to lose its meaning, or you become somewhat a little bit disconnected from the power of the thing that you're doing, right? And let me give you an example. Like, that could happen to us in the reading of scripture. Like, when you get so familiar with a story that you actually no longer enter into your heart. I was thinking about this the other day. Like, if you sat with somebody who had never read the Bible before, and they picked up the Bible and started in the beginning, and they start making their way through the story of Adam and Eve, you know what's going to happen? It's like, there's a point that somebody's going to stop and be like, I have questions about a walking, talking snake. Right? Like, when was the last time we read that story and went, that's not normal? Right? That's weird. But sometimes, like, that we've heard, when we hear the story so much, it becomes familiar that we actually don't even stop and be like, maybe there's some invitation into something deeper here. And does that mean then that we should avoid routine or habit or discipline because of the risk of familiarity? Dennis, does that mean we should avoid it? No. No. And actually, Richard Foster said this. Do we have our slides back? Oh, good. Spiritual disciplines are the main way we offer ourselves to God as a living sacrifice. We are doing what we can with our bodies, our hearts, and our minds. God then takes the simple offering of ourselves and does with it what we cannot do, producing within us deeply ingrained habits of peace, love, and joy in the Holy Spirit. And I want to remind us that we build routines and rhythms into our lives because it calibrates our hearts around the things that we say are most important. I don't know if you'll remember this, but probably the last time I spoke here, it was right when I'd come back from a trip to Albania, and I talked about how our deepest desires are the ones that are manifested in our daily lives and habits, right? Our deepest desires are the ones that turn into habit. Because otherwise I could say that I have a desire for financial freedom, but if I don't turn that into a budget, I'm probably going to live a different desire, correct? Right? So actually I have a deeper desire to spend and enjoy the moment than I do for the long-term goal. Right? So my daily life and my daily habits is that which reflect my desires. So it's super important that we build a life of intention, that we build a life where we've got rhythm and routine and habits that calibrate our heart. But on the other side of that, we have to recognize that there's the risk is that repetition can lead us into familiarity, and that in that place, it's potential for it to lose meaning. And that's the place where sometimes ritual can turn into religion, right? It becomes religion when I start going through the motions, when I do an outward behavior where my heart is now disconnected, thinking that the motion itself is that which pleases or appeases God. And what I want to talk about, that whole idea today, is in the realm of worship. You know, we're doing a, a sermon series called What is Worship? And honestly, if you missed Dennis's message last week, I would encourage you to go back to listen to it, because Dennis talked about why we worship, right? And that's kind of a foundational understanding. It's kind of hard to talk about the what if we don't even understand the why, right? And so Dennis really went over last week why we worship, and I want to take that one step further this week and kind of talk a little bit about, so if that's why we worship, can we make sure that we know what worship actually is? Right? Because I think there's the possibility, like hopefully worship is a part of our regular rhythm. Hopefully worship is a part of our daily rhythm. And you know, if you participate here on a Sunday, hopefully it's also a part of your weekly rhythm. But we don't want it to lose its meaning through familiarity. So I think it's really important that every now and then we actually stop and ask ourselves the question, what is worship and am I engaged in it? Because there's a pretty interesting way that we use the word worship, right? So we'll say things like, come to our worship service. We're about to enter into a time of worship. I was listening to worship music on my way to work. We call the person who leads our song up here our worship leader, which can tend to then point to the concept that worship is the part of the service on a Sunday where we turn the lights down, strike up the instruments, and we start singing. So then we kind of get the idea that, well, worship is when we sing songs about God, right? Yes? No. Which then, so if we follow that line of thinking, it leads us into comments like, worship today was so good. Or, I didn't really like the time of worship today. Or, I like this worship leader more than I like that worship leader. Or, worship was so anointed today. Can I just say that a lot of the times when we say that, that's code for like the worship leader sang my favorite songs this morning? Which then grips the idea that worship rises and falls on the song, the band, and the leader. And it's their job to make my worship experience good. Thank you, Tanner. Right? So is that a good definition of worship? Is it a good definition of worship? How about I ask this question? Is there such a thing as good worship and bad worship? Or is it possible that worship is either present or it just isn't? And that worship may be present in one person that's standing next to a person who worship is not present. Now, can I be clear? Singing is biblical expression of worship. Singing songs to the Lord, lifting our hands to the Lord, bowing down before the Lord, dancing before the Lord are all biblical expressions of worship. But can I make it clear that it is an expression, not worship itself? And I want to come back to the scripture that Dennis started with last week. It's in Matthew 15. This is Jesus speaking. It says, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. And in vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. And here he's actually talking about the Pharisees. And what he's talking about is in their following of God, the Pharisees have brought in a whole bunch of human tradition and they have departed from the way that God called them to worship. And they've departed from the way that God called them to follow. And what it does is it points to the idea or the possibility that there is a worship that's accepted and there's a worship that isn't. Or there's something that God calls worship, and then there's other things that he does not. Which points to the idea, it's kind of a biblical concept of the accepted offering, which then takes us all the way back to Cain and Abel. So we're going to land there a little bit this morning. This is Genesis 4. Now, the man, Adam, had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, I have obtained a male child with the help of the Lord. And again, she gave birth to his brother Abel. Now, Abel was a keeper of the flocks, but Cain was a cultivator of the ground. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord from the fruit of the ground. Abel, on his part, also brought an offering from the firstborn of his flock and from their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering, he had no regard. So Cain became very angry and his face was gloomy. Then the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry and why is your face gloomy? If you do well, will not your face be cheerful? And if you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Cain talked to his brother Abel, and it happened that when they were in the field, Cain rose up against his brother Abel and killed him. It's kind of an intense story. Right, but this is the first recorded time in the Bible that people bring an offering to God, and it's not because they're told to, right? They bring an offering to God in a way that makes it an act of worship. It's a worship moment. And yet you look and you realize one, in this moment, one offering is accepted and one offering isn't. And I think one of the ways that we can sometimes read the story wrong is that we compare Cain's offering to Abel's offering, and basically God rejects Cain because Abel was better. God is the parent who ultimately plays favorites, right? Now, can we ask ourselves if that's true? Because let's just ask, if both of your kids come home from Sunday school and they've done a craft in Sunday school, and they both come home and say, Mom, look at the, or Mom or Dad, look at the craft that I've given. How many of you throws one in the trash and puts one on the fridge? Because this one I like, and this one is not worth it. Right? Anybody? No, we don't do that. Well, I hope we don't do that. I hope we don't do parenting by comparison. No, we put out these great little offerings on the fridge and we tell them how amazing it is, right? And so the question of the story is not actually about who has the better offering in comparison to the other. The question of the story is, why did God accept one offering and why did he not have regard for the other? And this is kind of where it comes back to verse 3 and 4. Where it says, so it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord from the fruit of the ground. Abel, on his part, brought an offering from the firstborn of his flock and from their fat portions. The implication that you read is that Abel offered from the best of what he had, where Cain just bought from some of what he had. Abel brought a thoughtful and costly gift that revealed a priority in his heart for God. In contrast, Cain went through the motions, but without the same priority of heart. Would Cain's offering have been accepted even if Abel had brought none? No, because it was about the heart behind the offering. If I can describe it a different way, right? We have a 16-year-old and we have a 14-year-old. Over the years, it means that they've given my husband lots of gifts. I'm more of a gift person, so I help my children give him gifts. You know, I'll search his list on Amazon. I'll look for things that I know that he wants and I'll help the children get it. But can I show you a picture of the one gift that my husband keeps beside his bed? It's this. To be clear, I did not help with that one. Of all the years of gifts that my children have given him, this is one of the ones that he keeps in his room. Why? Because this gift, one of my children made at school, with him in mind, it's a fairly good likeness, and brought it home as a spontaneous offering to his father. Right? What did that gift mean to his dad? Thinking of you, Dad. I made something for you, Dad. I want you to have this, Dad. Why did it have meaning? It wasn't because it was expensive. It was because it came from a heart that wanted to please his dad. It came from a heart that was thinking about him. You know, it's for the same reason. I don't know if anybody else has had this, like kind of once you reach your adult years and then, you know, you do gifts inside your family and you've got a bunch of siblings and now they have spouses. And so then you all draw names at Christmas time. Has anybody else done this? Right? And then you give a gift limit. But then as what we started doing, especially on my side of the family, because they have three sisters, so it got really big, right? But then what you start doing is you all just start calling their spouse to find out the exact thing that they want. So everybody buys each other the exact thing that they want that's been communicated through their spouse. And basically you just move $50 around the circle. Now look, I'm not complaining. I like getting what I want. But it kind of removes the idea of the gift that came from the heart because I saw this and I thought of you. Right? What is the acceptable offering? It's the gift that touches the heart. It's the overflow of a heart of gratitude. It's the response of, I love you, therefore I bring my best. And what isn't accepted? Let me put it this way. Have you ever bought somebody a birthday present because they bought you a birthday present and then you felt obligated when it was their birthday? Come on, more than just me have done that. So their birthday comes around and you buy a gift out of obligation, but it's not like a connection of your heart or your value for that person. If you think about it in that context, it is not worship when your heart becomes disconnected from your offering. If my heart is disconnected from my offering, it comes back to that place of like, I'm going through the motions. I have a ritual without a reality. And it makes an interesting connection back to Matthew 15, where where Jesus said, in vain do they worship me. And when I looked up that word vain in my Bible tools, it actually said through the idea of tentative manipulation is what it said. Yeah, you know where I'm going. In vain do they worship me through the idea of tentative manipulation. What does that mean? It means that when we divorce our heart from our hands or our heart from the words of our mouth and we start going through the motions, what is my goal now? Right? And perhaps I know that it's the right thing to do and I want God to bless me. Perhaps I want his pleasure and I certainly don't want his displeasure. Perhaps I'm giving something because I'm hoping to get something in return. Can call that for what it is. It's manipulation. I do this so you will do that. Is that worship? Nope. Because at that point, it has become about me. At that point, I'm no longer actually offering to him. I'm looking for something for myself, and I have become the center of my own worship. And worship has just become a means to an end to get what I want. And I love what Bill Johnson says. He says, worship is not a means to an end. Worship is the end in itself. It's our highest calling. And when I make it about me, I turn it into a self-centered offering. And if you kind of look more deeply into the story of Cain and Abel, it actually implies that that's the kind of offering that Cain was bringing, right? Not to like dive into some of the whole roots of the story, but think about it. Cain was a farmer. What kind of thing does a farmer rely on that's outside of their control? Rain. And there's just the suggestion that perhaps Cain is bringing an offering to the Lord to get what it is that he needs. And here's the thing is, you know, you can kind of, you read these biblical stories and it becomes easy for you to stand back and criticize because it's in hindsight, right? And in hindsight, criticizing Cain is easy because you're like, Cain, that wasn't smart. But if I'm honest, right, I actually did the math. Well, no, I did not do accurate math. I did a major estimation that I've probably been in over 2,000 services in my adult life since I turned 18. Over 2,000 services. Like, that is a lot of opportunities to worship. I love somebody gave the definition like this. I would say it was a lot of opportunities to cancel the white noise of my life long enough to enter into the worship that has been happening since before the beginning of time. But can I honestly say that I've entered in every time? No, not if I'm honest. That I haven't come and existed in a worship service distracted and maybe weighted down by something that was going on in my life, sometimes. Could I say that I've ever sat down and disengaged because I didn't like the song? Sometimes. That I got frustrated or thought about things that I really wanted to say to somebody because I had a relational breach in my life during a worship set? Yeah, sometimes. Done that. Or that I've lost focus because something that somebody said on the stage or something that somebody was wearing or the way that the sound was coming across? Done that. Have I ever walked away and said it was a bad worship service? Because it didn't go the way that I thought it should? Yep, done that. And I'm guessing I'm probably not the only one. Okay, come on, am I the only one? A few honest people are like, okay, fine, me. You've got me, right? Which means that we are not as unlike Cain as what we would make ourselves. That there are times that we have brought an offering of our lips that was disconnected from our hearts. An offering of our hands that was disconnected from our hearts because we had a learnt behavior. Well, and here's the good news, because my goal isn't to heap condemnation on all of us. My goal is that even at the end of today, that we have a chance to return to an opportunity for worship and we purify our offering. Because we won't let our mouths go somewhere that our hearts won't. And so there's good news in the way that God responded to Cain. And I just want us to look at it. Because Cain basically threw a tantrum, right? He didn't bring a true offering. God said, hey, this doesn't work. Cain got mad. Cain blamed his brother or blamed God, we don't know, but he was angry rather than examining his own heart, right? Everybody else's fault. He was powerless over his offering, was he? No. And so God says to Cain, why are you so angry? And I love that because God just goes to the heart of the issue, right? Like, Cain, let's talk about the state of your heart. And for us, God might not be asking, why are you angry? For us, God might be asking, why are you disengaged? He might be asking, why are you disconnected? Why are you distracted? Why are you critical? I don't know. But in the place of worship, what we want to do is allow God to examine that place in our heart. Is my heart fully here? And if not, why not? And then I love it. God gives him a simple invitation. He says, if you do well, will your face not be cheerful? What's God saying? Cain, try again. Try again. Come back. The door is still open. Given you some feedback, there's an invitation to adjust. Cain, your offering may not have been accepted, but you are not rejected. Come back with your heart and I will meet you there. It's a real simple opportunity to adjust. And then there is a warning, and I think it's important that we pay attention to the warning too. If you do not do well, sin is lurking at the door and its desire is for you, but you must master it. Did you understand that God makes a connection between worship and sin? Which makes it possible that when we have sin issues, we have worship issues. And God's speaking to Cain and he's saying, Cain, there are desires that are competing for your heart and one of them is going to win. And the reason that Cain didn't put his heart into the offering is something else has already gripped his heart, and if he doesn't master it, it will master him. Right? And this is where I want to come back to. Worship is an expression of value, and my worship is pointed towards whatever I value the most. Dennis said this last week, you will worship something. And when I place God as my highest value, when I point all my desire towards him, all my other desires stay in the proper place, submitted to him. When he is my master, nothing else masters me, so my desires stay healthy. But when I allow something else to take the highest place of value, my worship shifts. And I invite something else into the place of mastery. And when I allow my appetites to take the highest place, sin as a result. So if I come back to the question, what is worship? The most literal translation you'll find, and Dennis talked about this last week, is to bow. To bow. But it's not just a physical action, right? It's an outward expression of a heart posture. And I love it how Skip Mullin wrote it. I think that's up there. Worship is showing reverence to God. It is demonstrating publicly or privately that I know God is the proper focus of my adoration and gratitude. I basically tell God that I know in the bottom of my heart that he is the king and ruler, the Lord and master of my universe and me, and he deserves my praise and my love and my respect. For me, this is a down on my knees expression, a physical demonstration of my humility before him, a deep and quiet contemplation of his authority over me. I let God's rule soak into my soul by mentally and physically bowing before him. This action is for God. Now, does it have benefit for me? Yes. But it's not why I give it. It's not why I give it. And in worship, I bring an offering, right? In worship, I bring an offering. What is the offering I bring in worship? Well, Romans 12. Therefore, I urge you, brothers and sisters, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies as a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. What is the offering? It's me. It's me. I find it so interesting when you look at that word, which is your spiritual service of worship. In other translations, it says your reasonable service of worship. Or actually, when you look at it in the Greek, it actually means your logical service of worship. What it means is that when you understand what God has done for you, and when you understand what God is like, the only logical response is that you would offer yourself. In worship, I become the offering, which means you can kind of see how it's possible that I could go through a worship service and never enter into worship. And it's a reflection that I just, again, is just the goal is to make sure that we're a people who bring a pure worship to the Lord, is that we re-invite that reflection into our hearts. That every time, and hopefully in your own life too, in your rhythms and your routines and your disciplines, that when you put on music or when you engage in silence, which is its own form of worship, that there's never a disconnection from your heart, from your actions. And what we want to do is we worship with our words and with our hearts, right? Tanner, if you want to bring your team up, we've got a little bit of time. And we're going to go back in, and here's where I have to be careful with my words. We're going to have some songs, which is an opportunity for worship, which is what only you can choose to do, right? And as we do that, and as they get ready, I want us to, we're going to do something first. I've actually been reading a book called Invitation to Solitude and Silence. And one of the reasons I'm reading it is I actually heard it said that we now have an attention span shorter than a goldfish. It's good news. But with what technology and the phone has done to our brains, our like attention span is now 7 seconds, which means that encountering God in stillness becomes more and more challenging for us because, which means like one of the great things that we can do to cultivate our connection with the Lord is relearning how to practice silence and solitude. And so I'm using this book as a way to guide me, to help me, because I'll admit I'm very challenged. But one of the analogies that it gave, and I just loved this, is it talked about how if I was to go and take a jar of water out of a lake or out of a river and put it down on the counter, that initially the water would be really dirty. It would have like layers of like small particles floating around and larger sediment and all of that. And it's only when we allow it to stay still over time that eventually the sediment and the dirt settles to the bottom and the water becomes clear, right? And it was really an analogy for what stillness, silence, and solitude does to our soul, is that in the stillness, God's voice becomes clear. And so one of the practices that it invited us to do was just to sit and allow ourselves to sit back and see ourselves as that jar and just be like, God, what is all the things that are going on in my heart that are competition for my heart's affections and making it hard to have the clarity of hearing your voice in the stillness? And just like that practice of sitting still and suddenly becoming aware, like, oh, there's all of these things floating in the water. No wonder I'm not clear in certain areas. And I just want us to take a couple of minutes and do that before we have the opportunity to worship, is just come before the Lord with like, here's my heart, God, help me bring the clarity. Is there anything floating in the water that is causing me to disconnect my heart from this moment or my heart from you or whatever is going on? Can you just help those things come into a place of stillness and settling so I can step above them and into the invitation in your presence? Can we do that? Okay, so I'm gonna just invite you to close your eyes and I'm just gonna give you like, Tanner, if you just give like 2 minutes and then go for it, okay?